All right, welcome to class today.
Glad to see you all here.
Before we begin, we should talk about the online quiz. Where am I? Or yes, as we begin. A lot of questions we did pretty well on, some that definitely deserve some more conversation. Let's start with this first one. We understood that a predicate with no variable is not a proposition. Huzzah. We understood that a quantified predicate is a proposition, could be true or false. We understood that a predicate with a known value variable is a proposition, but we're less united on the other two. If you have a variable that doesn't have a defined meaning and is not bound to a quantifier, then it is still an incomplete statement. It is not yet a proposition. It's a predicate, but not a proposition. And it is contradictory, meaningless, to say for all t where t already has a defined meaning. So for all requires an unused variable to follow it. And when the variable already has a meaning, you can't do that. We also couldn't, for example, say for all t if we had earlier in the expression had exist t, even if t didn't have a defined meaning otherwise. Right? So this last one is nonsensical to write. It isn't a proposition, it isn't a predicate, it isn't even a valid logical expression because we're trying to doubly identify what T means. I expected that to trip you up. I didn't expect it to be so exactly 50-50. But it is my intention to remove that question from the quiz's grading. I wanted you to think about it and to make the point, but there's that. Other questions about question one before I move on to question two? All right. Question two, we are pretty solid. Okay. There was a little bit of confusion on some of them. I mean, we don't have a whole lot of hundreds, but we've got a bunch in the 80-ish range. Okay. And it's worth noting here, for example, that if I say for all x, something that's false of all x, if I say it's true of all x, this goes back to our definition of implication. Implication is true if its antecedent is false. And so both of these become true because the antecedent is always false. We had more trouble with there exists something where something implies nothing. What is the x I should pick that will make this be true? Yeah, we'll pick one that makes s false, right? False implies false is a true statement. And because S is true for some and false for others, I can pick that false true. So I think that's what I'm going to say about this one. Any questions about question two? All right, and then we get to question three. Let's talk about this. I prepared some props to talk about this. All right. I am rewording the math in English. I'm going to reword it in this sort of oppositional style. So the first one, for all x, there exists a y, such that, etc. For all x happens first. So I'm going to assume that you all, as opposed to me, are going to be picking this person. You can pick anyone you want. No constraints on who you pick. I'm going to call that person x. After you pick them, then there exists someone. I only have to pick one person. So you pick anyone you want, I'll then pick one person, call them y, such that if x is in the class, then y is happy and x likes y. Okay, so this is sort of a game theory style way of describing this, right? I'm saying, hey, for all, you can do anything you want, exists, I'll do what I want, and then we can see if we can make this work. If we swap the order, we swap the order of those first two steps. With an exist first, I have to pick someone first. And after I pick it, then you can pick anyone you want. Okay? And so this one, I don't get to pick mine based on who you picked for yours. In this one, the for all happened first, and so the exist can depend on what we picked. In this one, the exist happens first, so you have to pick somebody that doesn't matter who else gets picked in general. So it's going to be harder to do the second one than the first one in general. There's less control to pick and choose the y we want based on the x. Before we dive into what this means for the three categories, thoughts, comments, questions about this way of posing these sentences? Okay. So we had three cases, and we wanted to know, do they do the same thing in each of those cases? The first one was, everyone in and out of the class likes at least one happy person. So the for all exists order, I can do it. You pick someone first, and then I pick the happy person they like. I don't even care if you pick somebody in the class or not, I can always make the right-hand side of the implication true. You pick somebody, I pick the happy person they like. If you happen to pick somebody in the class, we have true implies true. If you had somebody that doesn't, false implies true is also fine. I'm good either way. So therefore, this sentence is just true in this case. But we put it in the other order, it becomes false. Okay? I have to pick someone, and then you can pick anyone you want. So you could pick someone in the class that doesn't like them. Okay? And so, this one is false, that one is true, and therefore they are not the same under this circumstance. Questions about this? Okay. Next circumstance. The class is empty, no one is in it. This one is both true for the same reason. I can always do it. The if then never applies. That is to say, the antecedent being in the class is always false. False implies anything is always true. This is what we call a vacuous truth. That is to say, it is true by having a vacuum of things that could make the antecedent true. Since it is impossible to pick somebody in the class, it doesn't matter who we pick in our implication. This will always be false. And false implies anything is always true. And so it matters nothing at all about who either person picks for the exist or the for all. We're always going to have a true statement. Questions about this one? All right. And then we have, there's only one happy person in the world. Okay? So there's only one happy person in the world, in the for all there exists space. Can I do it? Well, I can do it only if everyone in the class likes that person. I have to pick that person because I need to pick a happy person. Why has to be happy? So I have to pick that one happy person. It removes the choice of what I pick for why. And so that simplifies the expression. If we remove the choice about who we pick for why, we end up with the expression for all x, c of x implies x likes that happy person. And if this is true, it's true. If it's false, it's false. I get the same thing if I do it in the other order. I still have no choice for the exists. Either way, I have to pick the one happy person. And since there's no choice, it doesn't matter what order the choices occur in. And so we end up in the same position for both expressions. Questions about this case? Okay, now. The answers we get don't look dramatically different statistically from random guessing. Okay, which suggests many of you didn't get here in how you think about it. So, how can I help you get here? I encourage you, when you're trying to evaluate the truth of something with for alls and exists, to think in this sort of oppositional strategy. Suppose one of the quantifiers is trying to force truth and the other is trying to force falseness, who wins? Okay? And that kind of approach will help you when you have multiple quantifiers. We aren't going to deal a whole lot with multiple quantifiers in this class. We'll see them occasionally. They will show up more the farther you go into the math of computer science. So computational theory will deal some more with meaning quantifiers. They turn out to be important things in analyzing medium to complex algorithms. We'll often have a formalism that involves alternating quantifiers. So this was sort of an exploration of it. Thoughts, comments, questions about this question? Yes?
That doesn't equal y, would that change anything?
If I had x doesn't equal y, how would this change? The fact I don't means we could pick the same person. Does that ever matter? It does for at least one. If there's only one happy person in the world, and that happy person is in the class, then I need to pick the person, X needs to be in the class, and Y needs to be a happy person, and so they would need to be the same. So if you had that doesn't equal, the world will be a little different there. I think for the other two, our arguments would be the same. Other questions? Okay. We did pretty well with the for all it exists. Like, you know, almost everybody was there. So hooray. If you were one of the ones that wasn't there, I still want to explain it, but perhaps you won't use class time for it. Come see me or TA in office hours. We're a little less solid on the does not exist. Because I didn't have a form that looks like the not of exist. I had the De Morgan's rule of that. Right? So most of you got there in the end, but some of you were confused by exists as alls and nots as nots, and yes, that's true, but De Morgan, when we're distributing the not, we have to put the ors to ands. So that is my comments on the take-home quiz. Any thoughts, comments, questions, other things you'd like to discuss before we dive forward with this week's material? Okay, then let us dive forward with this week's material. This week we're going to do several different things, but largely we're going to try to teach you how to actually write proofs. Our first exploration of actual proofs. We'll get into more and more complicated proofs as the semester progresses. We have had you do some logic towards the proof. In the quiz in week two we did that. But we're going to start talking more about some practical proof structures that will actually get used, as well as about prose proofs. And so we're going to start with some of those practical proof structures. We're going to talk about how do I prove for all x something is true? How do I prove there exists something where it's true? And then we're also going to talk about a particular proof structure called proof by cases today. I think that will take all of our day. If I'm wrong, we will move either some of Wednesdays to today or vice versa. But this is the main topics I want to discuss. And so let us sort of work through the basic approach. If I have other logic that already tells me things, then I can move forward more easily. But in general, how do I prove these things? Let's start with the exists. Okay? For the exists, I pick my favorite x. I pick the x that makes it as simple as possible to do my proof. I only need to prove something exists. It doesn't matter what I pick. The art here is knowing which one to pick. Sometimes it'll be obvious, sometimes it won't. But there's going to be things that'll make it easier, there's going to be things that'll make it harder. Okay? And so we can pick whatever we want. Let's take an example. Let's suppose that P of x means x is the sum of its factors. Now, I realize for some of you it's been a while since you've had arithmetic, and you may not remember exactly what a factor is. A factor is a number that divides evenly another number. Okay? So I'm saying here, I want to say the predicate is some number is the sum, add up all of the numbers that evenly divide it. Okay? And I want to prove this exists. What number should I pick? I want to make this easy. Yes? One. Let's see if it works for one. One is this. Okay, what are the factors of one? One. Check. Ta-da! Isn't life easy? Okay? So, picking the right thing, does this tell me anything about there being more of them? Nothing at all. One might be the only one. This might be true of every integer in the world. I haven't told you. All I've told you is there's something for which this is true. Okay? And if I were to pick something like, ooh, how about if I said instead there exists an x such that x is greater than 6 and p of x. Now I have made this much harder. Much harder. Because turns out 1 and 6 are both examples. Does anybody happen to know the next example? I don't remember the exact number. It's up in the 400-something. Okay? There are lots of these numbers, and proving that there is an infinite number of them is a complicated and interesting mathematical thing, but sometimes a simple statement, you just need to find the one, but how are you supposed to find the one? Okay? One way you could do this is write a program. And this is something that frequently actually happens when you prove existence proofs. We just say, I'm not going to be clever, I'm going to write a program with a loop. And it's just going to try everything until it finds an example or I get tired of waiting. Okay? And so we could write a program that finds a number, finds all of its factors, adds them together, sees if they are equal, and it could just keep going until either we kill it or it runs out of numbers or it finds one. And we could figure out what that next example is. The fact we used a computer to find it doesn't change our proof, right? Once we find our number, if we decide it was 6, we would say 6 equals 1 plus 2 plus 3. That would be the proof. And I might also have to argue that 1 and 2 and 3 are the only factors of 6 as another piece of this, okay? But that would be all I would need to do. So existence proofs need to find the magic example. Some of those examples are far from obvious. Let's look briefly at an example coming from the MCS book. I should have queued this up in advance. All right. So, let's look at proposition 1.1.4, Euler's conjecture. A to the fourth plus b to the fourth plus c to the fourth equals d to the fourth has no solution when a, b, and c are b, c, and d are positive integers. Okay? This is the statement. Note, has no solution. That's a does not exist thing. So a counterproof, a proof that this is wrong, would be an exists proof. There exists some a, b, and c that makes this true. The smallest known solution is this solution right here. 95,800, 217,519, 414,560, and 422,481. Hey, how are you supposed to know that? Well, the answer is you write a program. You just write a program that looks for examples. Sometimes you try to be a little clever to rule out some things to make it faster. Okay? But when Euler came up with this, before computers, everything he could try seemed to make this false. And so he convinced himself it's probably true that this is never the case. There's probably no example of this. And then eventually computers got fast enough and somebody decided to try it again and ta-da, found out, yes, there is a solution. Do we know if there's more than one? Our book doesn't say. Okay? I couldn't find anybody having found a second example when I went briefly trying to search for it. Maybe we'll have different luck. But anyway, right? So even though in theory it's easy to solve an existence proof, you just have to find some example that makes it true. Knowing where that example is can be tricky. So, how to prove there exists. Question about proving exists. All right. How about for all? How do I prove for all? You could argue what I'll do is I'll try every example. I could try doing an exhaustive proof. Occasionally, that's possible. Occasionally, the number of things you're making claims of is small enough and finite that we could actually do this. So you might consider, for example, computers typically will store the standard integer type is going to have numbers between effectively, it's going to have numbers between negative 2 to the 31st up to 2 to the 31st. There are variations on this. You get to learn more about this in other classes, but there's a finite number of integers most computers deal with. And so if I wanted to prove that some piece of code worked that took an integer as its argument, I could conceivably try all 4 billion and some integers and have an exhaustive proof of correctness. Now, even just 4 billion, that takes a while. Even for a computer, it takes a while. Sometimes that's doable, often it's prohibited. And so we don't generally actually do exhaustive proofs. Although we can, for some cases. But when we can't, the general way instead is we want to prove P of X assuming nothing about X. So when we run to prove it for all, we have to prove the thing without using any information about what we're proving. For an exists, we can pick a specific example. We can be as specific as we want. For all, we need to be completely general. Okay, let's take another example. Let's say P of X, okay, is the property that X plus X is even. I can write this down as a proposition. And assuming my domain is the integers, this is a true proposition. But how do I prove that it's a true proposition? I could just start listing off integers. I could say 0 plus 0 is 0, that's even. 1 plus 1 is 2, that's even. 2 plus 2 is 4, that's even. 3 plus 3 is 6, that's even. But it turns out there's an infinite number of integers. So this approach won't work. I can't do an exhaustive proof. So what I need to do instead is prove that x plus x is even without any reference to what x's value is. Now, this one, it turns out that we just say, by the magic of algebra, x plus x equals 2x, and then we could say, which is even. What have we really done here? We've just sort of appealed to your knowledge of algebra. And there are people that tried, I say even is probably not, the equals is probably not the right thing to say here, right? And we could go a little bit more, we could use the definition of even, that the remainder when divided by 2 is 0, and show that 2x divided by 2 has a remainder of 0, hooray, right? We can go more steps. How far we go down here is a matter of, to some degree, how much you're willing to believe other people's assertions. And there are people that try to break all of these things down, this tiny set of axioms, to see if they can prove all of math. And there have been several fairly famous people that have done this as their mathematics life work. But the idea here is, if I ever had to tell you what x is, I did it wrong. I didn't prove it for everything. If I can prove it without reference to x, then I have proven it works for everything. Thoughts, comments, questions? Okay. Now, when we're working proofs, we have several tools that we can use. We can use, and you've done a little bit with equivalences. I can say the things I know are equivalent to something, they're equivalent to something, they're equivalent to something that is the thing I want. I can use entailments. I can say the things I know entail the thing I want via several potentially intermediate steps. I can use this existential instantiation is the formal name of what we just talked about. Instantiation. I think that's right. This is where we pick our favorite value for the existential quantifier. Okay? I can also do universal instantiation, which is I replace it with a variable I know nothing about. And these are tools we can use to try to build a proof. Altogether, these combine to be the set of things that are most commonly called direct. We talked a little bit about this a couple weeks ago, I believe. But in general, these are all called direct proof. We just use the pieces we have to work our way forward. But sometimes that isn't enough. Sometimes we need fancier proofs. And the first fancier proof we're going to talk about is by cases. Okay? When we're talking about fancier proofs, and even these earlier proofs, sometimes it helps to have a formalized notion of the proof. So, let's just do the earlier ones first, and we'll get to this by cases. What does it mean to prove by equivalence? If I know that A is equivalent to B, and I know A, then I can conclude B. This is the formal structure of this proof rule. Okay? You tell me something, and you tell me it's equivalent to something else, I know that other thing. And so sometimes it's handy to sort of write down these general proof rules. Proof rules, it turns out, can also be proven, although often we assume people will accept them as being intuitive, right? If I tell you I am in the room and I tell you being in the room is equivalent to not being out of the room, then you know that I'm not out of the room, right? So we can do these kinds of just sort of general appeal to intuition. We have a similar rule, actually an identical looking rule, except a slightly different symbol, for entailment. If A entails B and I know A, then I can conclude B. Okay? So, for example, being in this room entails not being in Oregon. So since I'm in the room, I am not in Oregon. I can't go the other direction. There are plenty of people that aren't in the Oregon that aren't in the room, thankfully. It's not a very big room. So this one only works one way, this works both ways, but when we're applying it to a proof rule, they look very much the same. If I know something that entails something else, I know the thing it entails. For instantiation, what does this look like? If I know P of A for any A, then I know there exists an X such that P of X. So if you can pick any A you want, pick your favorite one. If you can show me P of A, then I know there exists some X that makes it true. Whereas the universal instantiation, again, has a similar structure, but is a bit different. Okay, so if I could say P of A with no knowledge of A, and I don't know what A is, then I can say it must be true for everything. So if you can show me that X plus X is even without knowing what X is, then I know that for all X's, X plus X is even. If you can show me that 1 plus 2 plus 3 is 6, show me there's a number that's equal to its factors, I know there exists one, but you had to pick a specific number such that only exists, rather than for all. This is a formal representation, quasi-formal for the second two. We could actually define what that means, but we're not going to. The book does, if you're interested. But this is a way of representing the proof rule. Question about these rules? Just for your information, my plan is to make sure that you can use the rules, but not necessarily tell me what they are. I'm not sure this was the right pedagogical decision. Perhaps you memorizing what they look like would help you use them, but I doubt that's the case. And so anyway, just for future reference, that's how this is going to work. So let's talk then about proof by cases. Proof by cases is a more complicated rule for a very specific reason we're going to say. We're going to say, I know A or B, and I know that A proves C, and I know that B proves C, therefore, I know C. There's several different things to understand about this proof. Probably the most important one is I have other proofs inside it. To write this proof, I have to prove other things in order to get them. Also, this gives me some extra freedom. I get to see because I know either A or B is true. I never have to figure out which one is true. If A was true, C is true for one reason. If B was true, C is true for a different reason. But either way, C is true. And so this technique of proof by cases is very often useful in the real world. We're going to start with just an English example of it, then we'll dive into a few logical examples of it and see how far we get. So let's start with an English example. I'm going to say it is raining or it is not raining. Now, you could argue that for portions of today, even, it's been sort of in between. Okay? So, you could argue that we don't really know this, but I'm going to assert that this is true, and you can either accept it or not. Okay? And now, I'm going to make some ancillary proofs. I'm going to make a proof that says, if I assume it is raining, Then, I use an umbrella. Therefore, I am not wet. Now, you could argue that this is a bad proof, because sometimes it's raining and I don't use an umbrella, and sometimes I use an umbrella and I still get wet. But just trying to show you kind of the structure here of how this works. So I'm going to say, all right, if it's raining, I use an umbrella and I'm not wet. If I assume it is not raining, then I'm just going to directly assume I am not wet, because clearly I never get wet except in the rain. And therefore, my big therefore, I am not wet. So this is the idea of a proof by cases. I assert that there's a set of things that must be true, and for each of those things, I show my desired conclusion. I haven't told you whether it's raining or not. I just said whether it's raining or not, I'm not getting wet. Because if it was, I use an umbrella. If it wasn't, there's nothing to make me wet. Now, this is, of course, a fallacious proof, hand-wavy proof, but it gets across the idea of the structure. Thoughts, comments, questions? Yes? If they're both false, then I was wrong to assert A or B. And so sometimes I will need to essentially prove that. And in principle, you could argue I have that implicitly before all of the antecedents of my proofs. I can't just tell you something is true. I have to have a reason to believe it. Other questions? All right. Let's try this. Let's try this with some actual logic. And let's see how proof by cases can help us. Let's start with this claim. Let's say that A XOR B is equivalent to B XOR A. This is what I want to claim. Want to prove. Now I just told it to you earlier. I just told you that XOR is associative, or commutative in this case, rather. And I just expected you to trust me. We're going to prove it now. We're going to prove it by proof by cases. Okay? First, though, this is an equivalence. And so proving an equivalence requires me to prove both directions of entailment. So I need to assume A XOR B. I need to show that A XOR B entails B XOR A. And I need to show that B XOR A entails A XOR B. So it means to show something is equivalent. Each of them entails the other. So let's start with this first one. The second one will be so similar that we won't bother doing it. Okay? I'm going to start with this first one. How do I show that you can swap the order? Well, I could try to find proof rules that will work, but we're just going to do by cases instead. I'm going to state that either A is top or it is bottom. Either it is true or it is false. And I'm just asserting this. Do you agree? Anybody disagree with this claim? It turns out that actually if you spend enough time on it, about 10% of the population disagrees with this claim. This is called the law of the excluded middle. And there are logics that reject it. But computer science is based on proofs that accept it, so we're going to accept it. Every predicate is either true or false. And so now I'm going to say, all right, let's check the case where A is true. And now I'm going to try to do a full proof where I know I want to show that AX or B entails BX or A in the case where AX or B is true, or A is true. So this means that AX or B is going to be the same thing as true XOR B. because this is the case I am in. And true X or B can be simplified. How can true X or B be simplified? Yes, it simplifies as not B.
Take a moment, make sure you agree with me.
Okay. That's interesting. I wonder where we go from there. What am I trying to get to? I want to eventually prove B, X, or A. So I want to show that this is equivalent to something that gets me in that direction. So I want to show that's equivalent to this. Do you agree with this step? And then I can turn that into A, X, or B. So I have said, all right, if A is true, I have shown you that A, so that's the same place I started. Ah, A, X, or B. What am I saying? B, X, or A. So I have used the simplification rule for XOR and my case that A is true to show you that we can swap between them, can make them commutative. I also need to run a case where A is the same thing as false. And it's going to look fairly similar, it's just going to have a different middle step. I'm going to say A XOR B is the same thing as false XOR B, which simplifies down to just B, which simplifies down to B, X or false, or unsimplifies, I guess, to B, X or false, which is the same thing as B, X or A. So now I've shown in the case where A is true that this works, I've shown in the case where A is false this works, and I've asserted that one of those two is true. And so then I can say, since A, X, or B is equivalent to B, X, or A in all cases, it is true in general. And this would complete my proof. Several things to note here. I started by saying we're going to prove entailments, and I actually proved equivalence instead. Ah, that's fine. Okay, it does prove entailment because entailment is a subset of equivalence, and I could work it backwards to get back the other way, but because I have equivalences all the way down, I don't actually need to do that. Also note that it is important to have all three parts of your proof. Part one, part two, and part three. Part one is you state the disjunction. What is the or, the disjunction, that is true that you're going to use in your cases? Sometimes you need to more than state it. If it's not trivially true, you might need to prove it as well. So if you want to show that one of these things is true and it's not obvious that one of those things is true, you may have to prove that. That is the first step. Step two is you prove for each case. And this is a whole proof. It can use any type of proof you want. It can use any of the five kinds of proofs we've talked about so far. Equivalence proofs, entailment proofs. It can do proof by existential instantiation, by universal instantiation. It can use its own proof by cases. It's a complete standalone internal proof that just has additional things we know. We know that both, we know the antecedent of what we're trying to prove, and we know the case we are in. And that gives us more power than we had before we got to the subproof, because we have more information. So we prove it for each case. And then the step three is we combine our results. It is relatively common for people new to writing proofs to skip step three. So there's also step one. Because step one is, yeah, okay, obviously. And step three, like, what is it really saying? Okay? But We don't write proofs to change what is true in the world. We write proofs to convince other people we know what is true in the world. Proofs are a form of persuasive writing. They are a language art. And there is rules to this language art. Just like you could argue the period at the end of the sentence serves no purpose, we could just omit it. And maybe that's okay when texting, but not when writing a paper. Same deal here. It's probably fine to skip this statement when doing a whiteboard proof, when just chatting with your friends in a proofy way. But when you're writing it down for somebody else, you need to conclude. It is also randomly traditional to put a tall rectangle to say I am done with the proof. Why this is traditional, I don't know, and I won't really care a great deal if you do that or not, but you'll see it quite a bit. Sometimes filled in, sometimes hollow box. There are actually relatively heated arguments and have been for many years about whether it's better to have a hollow box or a filled in box. Anyway, strange things people care about. All right, questions about this example? Okay. Well, where do I want to go? Let's go to... Nope, not this. Let's go to a link for today. And let me just make sure that we have covered what I wanted to cover. So, we have talked before about this lower level way of writing proofs. When we're writing proofs, though, we don't usually write them in this format. The For All X book likes to use this format. And it explains everything that happens, and you can abbreviate the right-hand column, which is fine. Okay. But most commonly, we'll write them in English. And there are some special words that we use. So we use rearranging for any of the associative, commutative, and distributive property, and any combination of them. And we use simplifying for sort of double negations and the various simplification rules we've had, and tautologies and contradictions, anything that sort of makes things smaller, all gets lumped in together. And so that proof we had up here, this six or five step proof, okay, this five step proof of this random theorem that A or B or C is the same thing as not B implies A or C, that theorem can also be written in English like this. A or B or C can be rewritten as blah, which is an equivalent to blah, by the equivalence of implication and disjunction. The end. Okay? So, often when we're writing English proofs, we're going to write in this way. Let me say some other things. Note the different typeface. There are weird rules about proofs. Proofs are always written in a serif font. Why? They just are. Okay, there's a lot of strange things about this language art that are largely signals to say, you should trust me, I'm an educated person, I have learned the same strange arbitrary rules you have. Surprise! Right? And if you don't do those, if you write your proof in a standard serif font, who is going to know? The answer is, everybody who's used to reading proofs, and they'll think it looks wrong. Are they right? It doesn't really matter. It's a signal of your membership in the group of people that can be trusted to write proofs. And you just have to deal with that. Okay? So we're not going to worry about you typesetting these and so on. Some later classes actually will, but this class won't. But there's rules and tricks to how this works. The level of detail you go into is a matter of opinion. Okay? And in particular, what you want, your goal in a well-written proof, you want the reader of your proof to believe that every step is obvious, but that they probably wouldn't have come up with them on their own, which is a weird balance. You want them to agree that, okay, yes, this follows from there. I can see how we got there. But you don't want it to be something that's like, yeah, why did you bother saying that? So you want to sort of balance between this inevitability and summary in your proofs. And that will vary based on your intended audience. In this class, your intended audience will be fellow students. I will generally ask you to prove things that I could just look at and say, oh yeah, that's true. You shouldn't write your proof saying, obviously true. That may work if your actual audience was people who teach classes in writing groups. But it doesn't work when your average audience is the other people in the classroom. So anyway, we'll say some more about this as we go forward. Entailments are very much like equivalences. And then we have case analogy, right? I've listed the three steps here with some extra writing. You state the disjunction of tautology, a set of ors that is true. Okay? For simple ones like P or not P, you're done. For more complicated ones, you may need to prove them as well. And traditionally, these get proved in a lemma. Lemma is a fancy word for a proof that we didn't care about but enabled another proof. And anyway, we'll say some more about that later on. You prove each of the cases in any way you want, and then you state that you know that it all works. And so here is an example. Okay, this is a fairly verbose example because I'm giving it to you early in the course. Later in the course, I write this shorter. But let's walk through how this works. Okay, this is one of our identities. We just told you it was true. We could have showed it with a truth table. Here we're going to show you in a formal proof. What does this look like? We say, we first, step one, state a disjunctive tautology. Either P is true or P is false. Because it's a simple one, I don't need to say more. And then I do the case. P is true. The expression P implies Q is, in this case, is equivalent to true implies Q, which can be simplified to Q. The expression not P or Q, in this case, is equivalent to false or Q, which can be simplified to Q. Since the two are equivalent to the same thing, they are equivalent to each other. Note, this is more verbose than just writing down a bunch of statements with equivalence lines between them and the names of the step. And that is appropriate. Okay? We're trying to write something for humans to read, and part of what we're trying to tell them is, trust us, we are educated. And so we write in this prose style. And we do the same thing for the other thing. Also something to note about our prose here. You've probably been taught when writing an essay to not mirror structure, to say things a little bit different if you need to say a similar thing. Use slightly different words for it. That is not the case in proofs. You want it to be easy for the reader to see everything is the same. And so you want to try to use the same words if you're saying the same thing every time you say it. So that people can glance at this and say, oh, this is exactly the same except that and that, right? Like there's just two places this whole line differs. For all four of those lines, hooray, it's easier for me to understand. I use exactly the same words in these cases. There's no magic to these words, but whichever one I pick here, I better use the same one in the other place. So that the reader knows that yes, everything is structured and logical and no funny magic is happening along the way. And again, step three, we always conclude by saying, it works in all the cases, so it always works. Thoughts, comments, questions? Okay. Yeah. Let's just briefly, so I talk here a little bit about this idea. This involves embed subproofs. Let me just briefly, because in your readings, this will be the format that is being used. Where do I want it to be? Why is this? All right. If you look in the For All X book, they do proof by cases in a very different way. Where do I have proof by cases? Here is their version of the proof rule. So they try to show everything in little steps. How do I show little steps when there's another proof? I put a whole nother proof inside my proof. So For All X book will give you a lot more hands-on examples, lots more practice of actually using this technique. And this is what it's going to do. To make the big proof, we make some small proofs inside. So they actually have some examples of how this works. This is what they all look like. They're a little cryptic, but they're also clear. When we come back on Wednesday, we'll show a few more examples of this. We'll talk some more about writing handwritten proofs. I will see you all on Wednesday.